Last two lectures, I mean, I know I'm one lecture in hand this week, but basically I'm thinking of these in units of five lectures. What I want to do is to now focus more on curvature. So for the next probably lecture and a half, although it's a single topic, what I want to do is use these techniques that I've been describing over the past few days to actually attack a physical problem. So it's going to be something that you're familiar with. It's going to be the metric around a star. But it's an example. You're going to see some of these things in action. So it's how do you use some of these techniques that we've been developing. And then to wrap up, sort of plug the rest of the other half lecture tomorrow, I want to tell you a little bit about integration on manifolds, because that's also something that's that's important in gravity, to have an action principle. We use this a lot, you know, whether we're just thinking in practice about looking at fields on space-times, whether we want to actually start thinking about instantons, whether we want to sort of look at our, you know, at a particular property of a space-time. So, you know, it's something that you really need to have seen. So I'll also want to cover that. So this, I'll call it lecture four, but it's probably four to sort of half of five. So the idea here is that you're going to sort of see how in practice, if you wanted to find the gravitational field of an object, how you would use the information that you had about the object plus these techniques to get the answer, at least if you're lucky. So what we're going to do, first of all, is to say, well, let's try and simplify the problem as much as we can. We want a space-time around a star. Stars roughly spherical, so we're going to just ignore all the details. And extract the sort of essential physics of the situation, or the description of the situation. So what this means in practice is, I'm going to obviously assume spherical symmetry. But I'm also going to say that my system is static, because unless you're in a very extreme gravitational situation, this is a reasonably good approximation. It should give us a very, very good answer. So this means there's, in particular, no rotation. So from these two statements, we know that there is a killing vector d by dt, and there's also an SO3 set of killing vectors corresponding to the spherical symmetry. We've got an SO3 symmetry, so we're going to have three killing vectors here. So what the symmetry or the killing vectors tell you is something about how to choose coordinates. So we The fact that the space-time is static, it's a little stronger than just saying that there's a killing vector that's time-like. It's actually also saying that we don't want rotation. So what this actually means is we can choose a time coordinate so that there's no cross terms in the metric. So first of all, it means that our metric is independent of time. So already we're in a reasonably good situation. We've managed to, you know, GAB is symmetric, second rank tensor. Technically, it would have 10 independent components. We just got rid of 3 of them. So that's a good start. So I got, have they got, you know, there's a question on the example sheet about the killing vectors, the SO3. Right.
Question 3, wasn't it? So, okay. Did people do the killing vector question yesterday?
Well, even if you didn't manage to do it, you know, if you've at least sort of seen it, so it's not completely mysterious what you had to write down. So, the spherical symmetry part means we've got this SO3 killing algebra. One of the questions actually asks you to verify that these 3 killing vectors do indeed form an SO3 algebra. So what it means, we can choose these theta and phi coordinates, which are going to coordinatize closed spherical surfaces. And these are going to be the surfaces along which the metric is constant. So let's just look at that and just, yeah?
I'm not sure why the time killing vector and static means that there's no cross terms. Can you explain that?
Well, if something's static, I suppose the easiest way of thinking about it is if it's static, if you just reverse the order of time, you're not really changing the system, right? And so if you reverse the order of time, you would have, if these were non-zero, you would have terms in the metric, dt, dx, for example. If you reverse the orientation of t, that would swap psi. So that's kind of the easiest way of seeing it. In rotation, you have cross terms in the metric of t phi, which is representing the idea that you're sort of, you know, your system is rotating around some central axis. So that's sort of the easiest way of seeing it physically. If something's static, it's time invariant. If you swap the order of time, you've got the same system, but these things would change sign, and therefore that would not be an invariance.
Cool.
kind of uses for the killing vector.
So just let's dig into this just a little bit more so you can kind of see a bit more how you use the killing vectors to derive some information about the metric. So remember that the killing vector says that the lead derivative of the metric vanishes along the, you know, the direction that's associated with that killing vector. So if I put in, for example, psi 3 here, this psi 3 vector is just d by d phi. So psi 3, which is d by d phi, if you thought about it as a component, this would be 0, 0, 0, 1. Okay? So if I then input into the formula for the lead derivative, which is, if I put it in explicitly, I'll just keep that there for reference. If this has just got a single number here, 1, obviously these derivatives are going to vanish. So all you get is that the derivative of g along the killing vector must vanish. Which was why I wrote over here gab dot vanished if d by dt was a killing vector. So that tells us that g has no dependence on the phi coordinate. And then I can look at, for example, psi 1 and see what that tells me about the remaining components of G. Remember, I've only killed off 3 of them so far. So now this is going to be a little bit more complicated because here the components of my killing vectors are non-zero. This has a theta component of sine phi and a phi component of cot theta cos phi. So the very first piece I pick up, so I want to take the derivative of g along the killing vector. I know d phi of g vanishes, so I just pick up the first term, that's sine phi dg by d theta. Then I've got to do all this other I've got to correctly encode this. So I have to take each of these components in turn. So if I look at my theta component is just sine phi. So here I simply pick up cos phi when A is equal to phi. My phi component, though, is cot theta cos phi. So I've got two parts to that. I've got minus cosec squared theta cos phi when A is theta. And then I've got minus cot theta sine phi when A is phi. Right, so now I just got to use this information here. Now, if both A and B are equal to either T or R, then all of these terms over here vanish because this second set of terms is only non-zero when one of the indices is one of the angles. So it tells me that in terms of the TR part of the metric, it mustn't depend on theta. And notice that this is true, actually, independent of this time, you know, the static condition. So if I was dealing with some more general space-time, but as long as it still had this spherical symmetry, I would still be able to deduce that the time and radial components could not depend on theta. So if I take now only one of the indices being T or R, and the other one being phi, and then I look along, I'll just, for the sake of argument, take A equals T, then I get that sine phi, G T phi, comma theta. So I want to now take B as phi, so I'm going to pick up this first term when A and B are swapped. And then finally, in the second one, if I want to have B as phi, I pick up the second term. So I know that my metric components are independent of phi, so that means that the sine phi and cos phi parts of this have to separately vanish. In addition, no, sorry, not ready for that bit yet. So now if I look for the other angle, so in this case, what I'm doing, I've just got to pick out the non-zero theta part, and that's just that second term. But I just showed that g theta t was zero, so that now tells me that g phi t or r is zero. So I've now shown that cross terms between the time and radial components and the angular components vanish. From the first one. Yeah. So I know I'm going through this in gory detail, but I thought after yesterday you might actually appreciate that. So, little bit of, not a bit of a rest. Okay, so what I'm slowly doing is actually shooting down as many of the metric components as I possibly can. The purpose of this is I'm illustrating how symmetries simplify metrics, but I'm doing it in particular detail to also exhibit how the Lie derivative works and how it can help you. So finally, if I carry a mental picture of what I've done with my 4x4 metric. I know I've got something here as TT. I've set these all to zero using the static condition. But what I also know is that even if I didn't have this static condition, I would know something more about the well, I suppose the T phi does require the static condition, but I actually can at least say T theta is zero in any case. So I also know that the cross terms between the radial and angular directions vanish. So I've actually started killing off a significant number of these components. So all I'm left with are these four. And I want to see, and of course you know that you can set some more of them to zero. So I'm just going to finish off here by writing down the final sets of the killing equations. For the angular components. So if I look at the theta-theta part, I've got sine phi g theta-theta comma theta. And here, this, I don't pick up anything from here because it requires something to be phi. Similarly there, but I pick up this term. So for the second one, where I've got a cross term, so if I've got one phi and one theta, I'm going to pick up quite a few terms here, actually. I've got cos phi g theta theta. Here's one theta. I've got minus cosec squared theta cos phi. A is theta, B is phi, G phi phi. And this one picks up minus cot. I'm sure I'm agreeing with that. And then finally, if they're both phi's, so those are my final three relations. So if I look at these, what I notice is the first one is telling me something about a relation between g phi theta and the derivative of g theta theta. But notice one's multiplied by a sine phi and one by a cos phi. So that's actually telling me that because I know my metric doesn't depend on phi, that tells me that, hang on, this should be, sorry, g theta theta comma theta. It tells me that g phi theta vanishes and g theta theta is independent of theta. So let me just look further down and see what else that tells me. Well, if I cross off my g phi thetas, what I'm left with here, there's another one, is that that's okay. This is pre-multiplied by cos phi. It gives me a relationship between g theta theta and g phi phi. And the bottom one tells me something about the derivative of g phi phi. So the second one is telling me that g phi phi is equal to sine squared theta times g theta theta. And then the bottom one, if I look at it, tells me that the derivative of g phi phi divided by sine squared theta vanishes, which is completely consistent with g theta theta being independent of theta. So that's the end of it. So what I know now is that this is, these cross terms are zero. This is some function here. And this is sine squared theta times the same function. So in other words, I've now got things down to just three metric functions from 10. So that was using symmetry. So what this tells us is that I can write it in this form. And usually we use shorthand for the metric on a unit sphere to just be d omega. So that's just a shorthand for the metric on a unit sphere. Okay, so now what I want to do is to use that Cartan formalism to calculate the curvature of this metric and then to find a solution. So if you remember, one of the things I said about using the Cartan formalism was that we wanted to choose an orthonormal basis. So what that means is, if I look at my forms, it's quite simple if your metric's nice and block diagonal. This is just simply going to be ADT, the radial form is BDR, and the angular forms so I've patterned the indices to kind of emphasize it's an orthonormal basis because I can't sort of easily distinguish here between coordinate basis and you know, if I'm labeling it with respect to the actual coordinates themselves. So the hat means it's one of the orthonormal basis indices. So in the, if I choose that basis, then my metric is simply the Minkowski metric because I've thrown all of the space-time dependence, these functions A, B, and C, I've thrown them into the basis forms. So what I then do is just take derivatives. So D of omega T is simply A prime dr cross dt, which is minus A primed on AB, omega T cross omega R. D of omega R is zero. d of omega theta is c prime dr cross d theta. And finally, so from this, I can immediately read off what the connection is, because remember by Cartan's equation, d of omega a is minus the connection forms crossed with omega b. Somewhere to keep an eye on them.
Yeah.
Yeah, why don't I write them in this corner here? Just leave them up. So. So I can see just by looking at that, I can immediately read off. Okay, so that tells us completely the Levi-Civita connection in the orthonormal basis. If it's not up there, it's zero. I want to compute the curvature, so I'm going to use that second Cartan equation, and I'm just going to recall that theta AC, which is obtained by lowering one of the connection forms indices using the Minkowski metric, is minus theta CA. So, for example, this would tell me that if I wanted to, say, reverse the order, sort of wanted to know what are the, if I wanted to swap the R and theta here, I'd have to get one minus sign from lowering the theta index, one minus sign from swapping the order, and one minus sign from raising the R index. So this tells me, for example, that theta R hat, theta hat, is minus theta hat, R hat. Okay, so that's computing the connection. Let me do the curvature.
So I'll start with the TR. So if I want TR, I've got to tell you D or theta TR. If I think about cross terms, the only non-zero component of the connection one form with a t-index is the r. So there's going to be no cross terms here because I would have to have trrr, and there's no component rr because it's anti-symmetric. So this thing is just d of theta tr. So this is simply d of, well, omega t was a dt, so it's d of a primed over b dt. So that is simply a primed over b all primed dr cross dt. And so I can rewrite this. So what I've done is I always want to have things in terms of my basis. So I always want to change these drs or d thetas or whatever into basis one forms. When I do that, I have to divide, because omega t is a dt, I've got to divide by a, so there's the a there, and I've got to divide by a b for the r, so that's the extra b there. So let me look at the other t components of the curvature. T theta, I've got no one form, connection form with a t theta in it, but I'm going to pick up cross terms. So if I look at the cross terms, if I put an r here, then I'm going to pick up something non-zero, because the tr, one form, yeah?
Oh. Could we try and calculate this with audience participation?
Okay.
I'm writing so fast.
You're the tutor. Oh, you've got me with my writing faster than the speed of light again.
Right,
sorry about that.
Good.
Yeah. Tutors, plea. Right, come on, guys.
Can you let me catch it right down first and then we'll try?
Thank you, darling.
No. It's supposed to be slower writing on a blackboard. It is slower writing on a blackboard. Trust me, you can write twice as fast without this.
But you already know what you're going to write. So we have to read it first.
Very true. Right, I'll put it down. Not that it helps. Yeah?
Those of us who haven't done differential equations before, could you explain how you're taking the exterior derivative of the omega?
So, in other words, if I was taking the derivative of some, well, Callum's catching up here, he's got right in the crap. So, in other words, what I did when I did, for example, sine theta d phi, something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. To a large extent, you kind of don't worry too much about the fact that this is a differential form, and you just sort of do the obvious thing, in that this form here, it's sort of in the phi direction, proportional to sine theta. So you could think of that as a, you know, if you wanted to write it down in components, you know, you would have, in this case, naught, 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 sine theta in the last one, yeah? So when you take an exterior derivative, this was this anti-symmetrized derivative. Now, if you look at it up here, this might be a sort of more, you know, a more familiar way of looking at it. You can see that the only thing this really depends on is theta. And so you would know that if you were trying to take a derivative, you'd have to take, it would only have a non-zero derivative if you were hitting it with d by d theta. So what you would say is, okay, so I know if I take a derivative of this, the only part I'm going to pick up is something where I've got a theta and a phi. So if I was looking now, if this was A, and I wanted to look at, you know, F mu nu, which was dA, Oh, shouldn't I? Never mind. Then the only non-zero component is going to be when one of these is a theta or a phi. And so I would say, okay, well, f theta phi is going to be d theta of a phi, which is cos theta. And of course, f phi theta would be minus cos theta. So let's look at what happens down here. So I'm taking d. One of the rules of forms is that d squared is zero. It's going to be a sort of form tutorial in some of this stuff, but more on forms. So when my d, I'm going to see a d of sine theta d phi, if I would be equal to d of sine theta cross d d phi, then it would be minus, because, sorry, this is a scalar, then it would be plus sine theta d of d phi, where I'm thinking of that as the one form. Now, d squared is zero, so that's that second bit vanishes. So what I'm all I'm left with is d of sine theta. So in that case, I just do the normal thing that you would do with differentiation. I'd get cos theta cross d phi. So if I now look at that and compare it with this, remember I said that with forms, f mu nu was a half fab omega a cross omega b. You can kind of see, well, here's my cos theta, which is the same as that theta phi component. D theta cross d phi is just d theta d phi minus d phi d theta. So you can see it picking up that part there. So it's exactly the same thing. But in this case, you're sort of not putting indices on it. And you really do just kind of do the obvious thing. And because you're not trying to keep track of all of these different slots here, it's actually, this is sort of quicker, because you're not sort of checking through this whole array of indices. Caught up, Callum? Okay. If you kind of do a few problems, it'll probably just sort of, you know, click into place. Okay, so here I'm just taking across a wedge product of two of these connection forms. And remember I said that r theta hat was minus theta r hat, so this is minus c prime on cb, omega theta hat. So given that, somebody want to guess what the T phi component is? Sorry, thank you.
Multiplied by sine theta.
In this case, I'm not sure I see where a sine theta is over there. So if we just do with the intermediate step. Well, there's no connection form with a T phi, okay? So the only way this is non-zero is if you've got a cross product of two connection forms, right? So just going by analogy, which two connection forms are they going to be?
T-R-R.
Yeah. So we're starting off with the same thing. And R phi. So is it going to be this or minus that?
Minus that,
yeah. So we're actually halfway there, because there's only six of these curvature two forms to compute. So I've done all the T ones, so now let me just fill in the theta ones. So if I look at theta hat R hat, is there a cross term? Yeah.
Sorry. Why is the theta form anti-symmetric?
Because it's an orthonormal basis. So if you just look back through the notes, you'll see that I've shown that if you're in an orthonormal basis, that the connection forms are symmetric. That's where that comes from. Yeah. Okay. Okay, right. Is there any cross term here? So if you just kind of look through, see what, you know, could there be a cross term? Phi, so there possibly could be. Now, tell me whether you think there actually is a phi, whether that cross term gives you anything. So you know it's going to be plus or minus these two multiplied together. That one and that one. So it's some junk, okay? This is like the junk. And it would be omega phi cross omega phi. Zero, right. So we picked up the fact that there's possibly a non-zero cross term, but now we've decided that that's zero. So all we need to do is simply differentiate this theta r term, which is this one here. And you can see that this is actually very similar to what happened with the time component. So, in this case, we've got something, you're sort of beginning to see patterns emerging. You've got something which went very much like the time component. Now let's do the phi. Okay, so what about those cross terms? See if we get a cross term this time. What index? Is there an index I can put here? Theta. Mm-hmm. So now if I look over here, I've got phi hat theta hat, which is an omega phi. And then I've got a theta hat r hat, which is an omega theta. So I am going to pick something up this time, okay? Because these are not the same forms. So I actually have to worry about that cross term. So my first term, if I look at the phi r, it is c primed over b sine theta d phi. And then I input my cot theta over c, omega phi hat,
cross the theta r which is c prime on cb omega theta hat. So for the first piece, I do differentiation like before. And then I'm just going to write explicitly what the one forms are here. So that you can see it more clearly. So what do you notice about these two terms here? They cancel, yeah. So those two cancel. So in other words, what I've got here is something which, again, looks like the theta terms and the time. So in this case, the cross term was important to cancel off the way this theta dependence. Was acting on the d phi part. So we've only got one more to do. So cross terms. Spot which one it is. So if I put in my phi theta there, that's cos theta d phi, if I write it down. And then I've got phi r and r theta was, of course, minus theta r. And so, having made that comment, do you want to just have a shot at doing this? What would this be?
This would be my sine theta.
Yeah. Exactly. So if I now put this back into my basis of forms, I'm going to end up with 1 over c squared. Minus c squared over c prime squared over c squared b squared omega phi cross omega theta. So these are the curvature two forms. If you remember, they're just taken by using the Riemann tensor and mopping up the last two indices with the basis forms. So although it took us a bit of time because I got told to take a bit of time, if you think about it, each of these computations is like about two lines, okay? And there were six of these curvature two forms to calculate. And what we've now got is the Riemann tensor for this particular metric. So although we've gone more slowly, because it's unfamiliar, it's new, what we've got is every single component of the Riemann tensor for this space-time. what we'll do tomorrow is actually just unpick it and peel off these individual components and then use them to get the Einstein equations. But this is considerably easier and it has fewer margins for error than sitting down and actually trying to do, you know, sort of track through the formula and computation involving the gammas and derivatives of gammas. So it's a useful technique and it's something that works extremely well. Also, if you have, when we come to doing extra dimensions, I'll also use this general technique to show how Kalitza-Klein theory works. It's again a fairly straightforward way of deriving how curvatures transform. Okay, that's it for today.